Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week I speak to Robert Arameo and director Kirk Jones about the heartwarming, funny and sometimes heartbreaking movie I Swear, based on the story of John Davidson, who was diagnosed with Tourette's syndrome when no one knew what it was, and who would go on to become an activist and advocate for understanding the condition. Chris Wasser reviews The Smashing Machine with Dwayne The Rock Johnson, as well as Jim Sheridan's new film Recreation, plus all the TV you want to stream or skip. You can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well and surviving the inclement weather. Storm Amy, I'm sure like plenty of households in Ireland, we have an Amy in our house. Our middle child is Amy, and she's surrounded by a younger and older brother who made heavy weather, if you'll pardon the pun, of a storm that is both volatile and changeable and unpredictable, being named after her. Brothers and sisters, eh? Nothing changes. Anyway, this week in TV, I was watching this.
What are you doing?
I don't know.
The radio up, you're up next!
Oh, 1 second! Hey, are you seriously quitting right now?
This is so stupid. Literally, look how stupid this is.
You're dropping the ball, man. You're dropping it right before the end zone.
You watch your mouth, catfish.
If you're quitting, why are you still doing the voice?
I don't know. I'm being insane. I feel f***ing insane right now.
You know what else is insane? How you probably think if you just hadn't dropped that football in the Rose Bowl, your life would have gone different. Guess what? It wouldn't have. You still would have ended up right here, because you're you.
I should kick your ass.
That's what Russ Holiday would do. Do you want to be Russ Holiday? Or do you want to be this guy? Whatever his name is.
Radio! You gonna come play football?
Did you think of a name?
Yeah. My name's Chad Powers.
Yes, that was Glenn Powell playing Chad Powers. This is a new series on Disney Plus that landed earlier this week or late last week. I can't be sure at the time of talking to you, but it is new, dropping every week. There's 2 episodes up there. I've watched 4 at this stage because I'm a very important person who gets advanced screeners of things. But this is Glenn Powell playing a guy called Russ Holiday, who was a big college football star. And college football, as you may know, in American football in America is huge and nearly as big as, you know, kind of regular NFL football. And basically, he messed up royally at a very important game, had some bad years then when he hadn't made it as a big football star. And we meet him now 8 years after that meltdown on a football pitch, and he's bought a cyber truck, he's dabbling in crypto, he's obsessed with outlandish conspiracy theories and social media, but he really wants to be back playing football. There's an open call for a new quarterback on a college football team, and kind of aka Mrs. Doubtfire or Tootsie, he uses prosthetics and dresses up as, well, not dresses up, changes his appearance, because as it happens, his dad is a props guy for the movies. And he dresses up as this guy, Chad Powers, takes on this identity and goes and tries out for this football team. And lo and behold, gets on the football team. Now, here's the thing. This is kind of, you know, maybe aping things like Ted Lasso or even Stick, which you talked about a few weeks ago. And it's kind of quite predictable, and it follows probably plots or a plot line you might nearly expect. And there's the main coach in it's great. Steve Zahn plays him. A lot happens that you might expect, like his dealing with this new identity, not figuring out how he's going to ride the two personalities that he's now inhabiting. So it's kind of predictable and what you might expect. But it's very funny. I've really laughed a lot. And even sitting down to watch it, I was thinking, I'm not so sure about this. Do I really want to watch this? I kind of know where this is going. But it's kind of better than the sum of its parts. It's just really funny. I had a lot of belly laughs in it. Glenn Powell is brilliant as the guy he becomes, Chad Powers, because he spends most of the series dressed as Chad Powers. You probably know where it's going, but it's well worth a look. I think now more than ever, when we may be looking for a laugh, you will definitely get a laugh from Chad Powers. It's on Disney. Check it out. I'd love to know if you might have been watching it. You can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Steve Zahn, by the way, you will know him. Even if you don't know him, he's been in so many things. He played one of Phoebe's former boyfriends and friends. He's the dad in the second season of White Lotus. He's just that guy. You're like, oh, that guy. These great blue eyes that give him a kind of presence. Anyway, it's very good, Chad Powers, and I wasn't expecting it to be on Disney. Something else I was watching this week is this.
You bet mom's money on the Knicks.
A lot of people bet the Knicks, Jake. They're a professional basketball team.
And the money you got from the restaurant?
It's the one you and Naveen kicked me out of?
Yeah, bailed you out. Saved your fucking ass. You gambled that too, right? Then you go down to Junior, take a loan on the house, you bet it again, lost it all. And then you skip town. Sound right?
Sounds like the least favorable way you could possibly phrase it, but yeah, you're all caught up.
Yes, the unmistakable, are they unmistakable? I think they are, sounds of Jude Law and Jason Bateman. You may have heard about this. This is from the show Black Rabbit. The Black Rabbit is the name of a restaurant in New York that Jude Law runs. He formerly ran it with his brother, but then his brother left, as you heard there, for various reasons. But his brother is back. So we have, you know, this is on Netflix, but something that you might think is approximate to The Bear, about a family running a restaurant. And I guess there are similarities. Jason Bateman plays the brother Vince, and he repeatedly screws up. And it's Jake, played by Jude Law, who's constantly left to pick up the pieces. It begins basically with something very violent, a robbery of sorts in the Black Rabbit, and we backtrack to see what binds these two guys together. The two of them together are brilliant, and separately. There's lots of other actors and actresses in this, but in a way, they are completely the star of the show, and it's their kind of Cain and Abel vibe that's making this work so well. New York looks great, and it all seems to have been shot on location. I don't know if it was or not, but it's very New York-esque. I don't know why anyone would open a restaurant in these shows, because it never ends well. But this is pretty gripping stuff, based solely on the performances of Jude Law and Jason Bateman. It's been there since last week, or even the week before, but I got around to it this week. I found it very entertaining. It is grim, because a lot of bad stuff happens. So, you know, we were talking about Chad Powers cheering yourself up, given the state of the world. This won't cheer you up, but I do think the two central performances from the aforementioned Jason Bateman and Jude Law carry this. So a big thumbs up for Black Rabbit on Netflix. Now streaming 8 episodes of that, I believe it is. Or is it 7? I can't be sure. You know, talking of grim TV, I mentioned it a few weeks ago. Still lots of people getting in touch with me talking about Task on Sky. It's the best show of the year so far. As much as I've enjoyed the other shows I've been talking to you about, but a few people got in touch about Task, saying how much they're enjoying it, with Mark Ruffalo heading a task force, taking on a biker gang and another gang who are taking down this drug biker gang. So do check out Task if you haven't seen it. And then finally, in this week's TV, I do want to mention the Walsh sisters. So this is RTE's show on Sunday nights, based on a couple of the books of Marion Keyes. I think it's 2, Rachel's Holiday and Anybody Out There. I've never read a Marion Keyes novel, much to my chagrin and shame. I've just never gotten around to it. I think she's one of the most delightful people I've ever heard in interviews. She's just so honest and delightful. The type of person you would love to talk to. If she's listening, I'd love to talk to you sometime, Marion, because I think you're a great interviewee anytime I've ever seen you being interviewed on all sorts of things, from Elizabeth Day's podcast, How to Fail, or Tommy Tiernan. But this is the series about 5 sisters. We have Anna, played by Louisa Harland, who's from Derry Girls and almost unrecognizable in this, but a great actress, of course. Rachel, played by Caroline Menton, who's kind of the screw-up of the family, if I may be so bold. She's, in essence, an addict. She has a lovely boyfriend. Claire is played by Danielle Galligan, who was on the show last week because she plays Lady Olivia in The House of Guinness. She plays a newly single sister. We've Helen, played by Mairéad Tyers, who's the youngest sister, and Maggie, kind of the sensible sister, who's also married, played by Stephanie Prisner, who also co-wrote the script. This isn't getting great reviews, and I don't think that's fair. Now, I have only seen one episode because that's all I could get my hands on, but I thought it was pretty pleasant, I have to say. I like the family dynamic of the five sisters. Carrie Crowley plays the mother of the family, who's not very nice. Aidan Quinn plays kind of the dad, who's maybe a touch long-suffering, but loves his girls. But I thought this worked well as a kind of study of Irish sisterhood. It's not the greatest thing since sliced bread, but I think some of the reviews have been a bit unfair, to tell you the truth. Now, one thing I thought was the male characters are kind of underwritten and are a bit one-dimensional. But I thought the five sisters and the lives they're inhabiting together worked pretty well. And I'm looking forward to seeing where the series goes. So I think so far so good with the Wall Sisters on RTE1 on Sunday nights. So, check it out, The Walsh Sisters. Now, I want to get to movies. And after the break, one of the best movies of the year that's coming out next week is called I Swear. You won't want to miss this. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, I Swear tells the extraordinary true story of John Davidson, who was diagnosed with Tourette syndrome at age 15 during a time when the condition was largely, hugely, completely, I would suggest, misunderstood. A rift develops between John and his mother, Heather, played by Shirley Henderson, when he forms a bond with Dottie, played brilliantly by Maxine Peake, the terminally ill mother of a school friend. As an adult, Davidson, played brilliantly by Robert Arameo, emerges as a tireless campaigner for awareness and acceptance of the condition, working as a community caretaker and founding a support network for individuals and families affected by Tourette's advocacy work, for which he receives an MBE in 2018. And if the movie is to be believed, said something rather inappropriate when he received that MBE. I Swear explores David's journey from isolation to empowerment, illustrating how he embraced his identity and inspired a new compassionate understanding of Tourette syndrome. John is played brilliantly, as I said, by Robert Arameo, who many will know as the young Ed Stark from Game of Thrones, and more recent viewers might know him from Elrond in Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power on Amazon. It was written and directed by Kirk Jones, who gave us one of the most financially successful movies of all time in the form of Waking Ned. More of that later. He also did things like What to Expect When You're Expecting. And I'm delighted to say both Kirk and Rob join me in corporeal form in studio here in Dublin, Ireland. Gentlemen, thank you both for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that long intro. I should really keep them shorter. But I wanted to give the movie its full billing. And I'm going to say at the outset, it's terrific. And this is a film people are going to be watching in schools in years to come for all sorts of reasons. Kirk, you're a human being and a compassionate one, I'm assuming, but you're also a storyteller and you want to make movies. Like, was there a moment you thought John Davison's story, while hugely emotive, could be the basis of a pretty powerful story?
Yeah, I think for me, the journey started in 1989 when I saw the first documentary
about
John.
That long ago?
That long ago. It was called John's Not Mad. And I sat and watched a 15-year-old who was being told by his school that he would either end up in prison or he'd end up in a mental asylum. And I continued to watch him grow because there were a number of documentaries over the years. I saw him in his 20s, saw that he desperately wanted to find a girlfriend, but was saying, you know, who would want to go out with me when I just spit in people's faces and swear at them. Then in his 30s, he started to work with the Tourette's community and realized that he had, you know, that was his purpose, to bring people together. And it wasn't until 3 years ago when I sat down and tried to decide what my next film was going to be, that I looked through a book of notes, an old book, and it literally just said John Davidson Tourette's. And I thought, I remember that guy. I'm gonna rewatch those documentaries. I love them. I couldn't believe that no one else had contacted him and wasn't working on a film project, because to me, the combination, you know, of the humor and the emotion, which is all wrapped up in this very complex condition, I couldn't believe that no one else had made a film. So I went up to Scotland and met him. He was anxious about meeting me, not so much because I was a stranger and, you know, I'd just come up from down south, but because John and people in the Tourette's community had for many years been kind of mistreated by the media.
Yeah.
They'd been put in films and TV shows and brought into radio stations. And essentially people just wanted them to be a bit of a gimmick and to say something crazy online.
Yeah.
So that really was, that was my journey with John. And that was about 2.5 years ago that I met him.
Okay. And Rob, how much or how little or any time did you spend with John to get in to playing him?
Yeah, I spent months with John.
Right.
As soon as I could, I went to Gala Shields and based myself in the prep period in Gala Shields and spent as much time as I could just not only being with John, but also his family and also Gala Shields itself, which is a real character. Mm. It's a really interesting place and really awesome landscape, and you know, like that river is such a part of John's life, and you know, so like I really just wanted to, as much as I could, immerse myself in his world as well as being with the man himself. But you know, I had many dinners with him and watched football with him and went to the community centre with him, and you know, just sort of spent as much time with him as I could.
And do you try and ape him? Do you try and do your own take on him? Like, in terms of, you don't want to do an impersonation, but yet you want to be honest to who he is. So maybe it's a bit of an artsy question, but where do you find that line?
Yeah, well, I just sort of like, it was almost like as if the gates were open for a certain degree of time, and I was just gathering as much as I could, not just from John, from anyone that I could meet that has lived with this condition in one way or another, you know, whether they have it themselves or a loved one or... You know, I read books, and there's an amazing book called My Non-Identical Twin, which I love.
My Non-Identical Twin.
Yeah, which really helped, by a wonderful writer. Her name is Evie, I think. And then at a certain point, I mean, one of the, you know, I said, you know, to Kirk that right from the word go, it wasn't my intention to do an impersonation of John. More to try and find John's energy, really, and try and play with that energy. That was what was most important to me. To impersonate him would have been wrong, and I think would have led me down the wrong track. So for me, at a certain point, I just had to sort of go, right, this character is mine now. I've done all my research, and John the Man is part of that research, and now I'm going to try and take ownership over it. And you know,
well, you did a hell of a job, my friend. You really did. Let me ask either of you this. So I told you I watched it with my wife. And she's raving about it, as am I. But we laughed a lot of the time because he says these wildly inappropriate things. And then you compose yourself again and you go, I'm probably not meant to be laughing at this. Am I?
I think you are. And it was one of the first questions that I asked John. I said, if I feel that I can identify a level of humour in your life and in your journey, would that upset you? Would it annoy you? Would it frustrate you? And he said, absolutely not. He said, my life has been, you know, one of the funniest, but at the same time, tragic journeys you could ever imagine. And as a writer and as a director and as someone who wants to put stories, you know, on the big screen, I was really excited by the proposition of just kind of smashing together humor and emotion at the same time. And I think audiences love that. I think sometimes filmmakers are you know, treat the audience as being too sensitive, and they think, well, this has got to be funny, and then this has got to be, you know, emotionally engaging. And I think audiences love it when things are kind of mixed up, and it delivers what people often refer to as a roller coaster. You know, it's up, it's down. And you don't know whether you're laughing or crying, or you're crying with laughter and then you're crying because you're upset. And so I'm really thrilled. Having said that, I was nervous and I was anxious that this might not work out. You know, Rob and I had many conversations about tone, and we tried a number of scenes in different ways, slightly different tone, playing for the comedy a little bit, then playing it a bit darker. And when I was in the cutting room, I kind of started to piece it all together. And, you know, I was very excited to screen the film. We did like some market research screenings very early on, and people were laughing and they were crying, and they seemed to know when to apply the correct emotion. They got, you know, they got the drift of the film and kind of went with it.
Yeah, because you're played like an accordion, and I mean that as a compliment. Mm. Like, there are moments of just utter heartbreak and then moments of utter hilarity. And one of the few I can repeat is when he meets Peter Mullen for the first time and screams out about a wrinkly old man.
Mm.
I don't want to say what the line is. When he accepted the MBE, did something like that happen?
Yeah, and when I spoke to John, you know, John's funny because there's so much has gone on in his life that he kind of forgets stuff. And, you know, we were only a couple of weeks out, or maybe a bit longer, from shooting. And I was working on the scene where he receives his MBE, and I thought, I don't know if I got enough information about it. So I said to John, like, just tell me about more. Tell me a bit more, you know, about that day. And he said, oh, I did this. I was wearing this. Oh, and by the way, I insulted the Queen by shouting out. And I thought, well, why didn't you tell me that before? So that went straight in the script, and that opens the film.
Yeah.
Because it just kind of sums up John. It sums up how difficult the real world can be for him. But it also sums up how funny his condition can be at times, and that he is prepared to laugh, and other people with Tourette's accept that, you know, there is a level of humour there.
Yeah. Rob, you know, I mentioned the heartache in it as well as the laughter. One of the hardest things I found is he comes to a realisation that in essence his parents broke up because of him, which is heartbreaking. And to come to that realisation as an adult, like, it just, we're all human beings who had parents. Did you meet his mother for this?
I did not.
Okay.
No, I did not. Keck can probably speak more articulately to the creation of Shirley's character, because I know there was a lot of delicacy that went into how you went about writing her, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at the documentaries, I think it's fair to say that some people come away. And again, it's very unusual to be able to go back and look at a character's development from 15 through 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. I think it's possible to come away from those documentaries thinking that the mum was at times not as sensitive as she should have been. And I didn't want to paint the mother in a bad light, and mostly because I am a parent, and I'm not sure that I could have coped with the behaviour that John was displaying when he was that age. I didn't want to judge the parents, because I know how hard it must have been. You know, he was going to the supermarket and saying things to their friends, into the community. He was shouting, he was swearing.
And it was the 1980s.
It was the 1980s as well, and people just didn't understand.
Yeah.
So there's a scene in the film where John and his mother kind of reconcile their differences in what feels like a very natural way. And I was really keen that we didn't just let mum, you know, just drift away and be seen as someone who didn't help that much, because I don't think that's the case. I think she did care, and I think she did do her best.
Mm.
Yeah.
Rob, there's a physicality to your performance, because Tourette's is complicated, and we might talk about that in a second, but aside from him shouting things out, at times his body's incredibly tense, you know, and there's twitches to his neck and things like that. I remember, maybe it's a strange question, but I remember Al Pacino after Scent of a Woman saying for about 6 months he didn't blink his eyes because he was so used to playing a blind person. I'm wondering, did it take you a while, because, and listening to the research you did, you were so subsumed in who John was. Was it strange when it finished? Was there a physicality hangover nearly to it?
It was very difficult. It was very difficult. I don't want to go too much into it, but it was, it was a difficult thing to leave.
Yeah, I can imagine.
No doubt. But I think what was interesting about his physicality was that, and this is like so rare, but this is what's wonderful about Kirk, is that he would allow me to walk in on the day and be like, I think this is a very ticky day because of the echoes in here, because of that light, because there's more people in this room right now. Like, literally, like, how ticky he was that day and in that scene was sometimes determined by, as it is, the location and who was around him and what the environmental factors were. So, like, I really enjoyed that I was given the opportunity to bring that in, because it allowed me to sort of think, right, okay, I'm just going to focus on authenticity with John and then let Kurt guide me at certain moments, but I'll put John in the room. And that was what was at the sort of forefront of my mind. Because it's so difficult to represent something like this authentically. It's really, really difficult.
Yeah. You know, Kirk, in a week where the person with the highest office in this side of the world is talking about links between autism and paracetamol, I'm very conscious of dispelling medical myths and things like that. But it is fair to say, in terms of Tourette's, which I knew very little about, the type of it that John has, if that's the right terminology, where he shouts things out, is rare in the spectrum of Tourette's, right? I mean, a lot of people would have Tourette's and it would just be a question of tics and maybe grunting or things like that. But this idea that people go around all day saying F you, it's a limited number of people, right?
It is. So I had a lot to learn, and Rob had a lot to learn, you know, about the condition. So only about 10% of people have echolalia, which is a...
Coprolalia.
Oh, sorry. Coprolalia. My fault. Have coprolalia, which is a form of Tourette's where you do swear and you do shout things out. The other 90%, and the other thing to mention is that no two people really have the same form of Tourette's. You know, people just twitch. They might blink. They might say, you know, they might just say donut all day and not swear. That's one of the first things that I started to learn about Tourette's, is it's a lot more complex. I think most people, unfortunately, and maybe I was like this in the past, just think that if you have Tourette's, you walk down the street and you shout and swear at everyone. And the stereotype fitted quite nicely. You know, that was quite funny. It was quite weird. It was quite unusual. But it's much more complex than that. And then, of course, when you talk to John, you speak to other people who live with this condition, you realize that it's not just about the swearing or the shouting or the physical ticking. It's a lot to do with being incredibly exhausted during the day, because when John, for example, goes to the supermarket to buy a pint of milk, he doesn't know what's going to happen. Is he going to get arrested? Is he going to hit someone? Is he going to upset someone, make someone cry? Is it going to be a good day? Is he just going to get his milk and come
home
again?
And that level of forward planning must be exhausting. Like, exhausting. People without Tourette syndrome, I woke up this morning going, I have to do this, I have to do that. And that's tiring. But the level of detail people must have to think through on that just must be, as I say, exhausting.
Yeah, but also, like anything, you know, some people are able to suppress their tics, and a lot of young people go to school and they're desperately trying during the day to suppress their tics because they don't want to be singled out or they don't want to stand out from their classmates. And then what happens, they get home at night and they have something which is called a tic attack, which is something that we featured in the film. It kind of all builds up and it just kind of all comes out at once, and that can be quite dangerous and physically really, really draining as well.
Yeah. Tell me this, as we near the end of the conversation, Rob or Kirk can answer this, but I'm always fascinated when a person who is in real life has a movie made about them. What's John's reaction to this? And either of you can tell me.
You answer that one, Kurt.
Yeah, I mean, John loves it. He's very proud. He's very excited. He admits that right from day one, he was nervous. He was anxious. He wasn't sure how it was going to turn out. We showed it to Tourette Scotland, were one of the first audiences. They absolutely loved it and adored it. Rob is really proud of, sorry, John is really proud of Rob and the way that he's presented himself and can't imagine anyone else, you know, doing a better job. So he's
and
very happy.
Freudian slip there of mixing up the two names shows the testament to how much you inhabited him. Yeah, you really did.
That's true.
It's not just me as well. It's Scott Watson
who
plays the younger John. He's incredible.
And I thought there was, I hope you'll take this as a compliment, in the early days when he's first diagnosed, there was shades of Cares, that great
I love that film.
And there were shades of that, as a compliment.
Well, I do, a huge compliment. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that it was grounded and it was kept real and believable. And that felt to be the only way to present it. We didn't want to make it cheesy. We didn't want to make it, you know, comedy. We just played it straight because we knew that John's life on its own had plenty of comedy and tragedy already built into it.
Rob, I've spoken to a couple of people who were in things like Star Wars, Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings. And I'm thinking of, who am I thinking of? Someone famous whose name momentarily escapes me. Does the level of recognition after you've been in anything to do with Lord of the Rings kind of surprise you and shock you?
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose so, yeah. But one of the funnest things, though, is going to Comic-Con.
Right, yeah.
You know, we always go to Comic-Con to promote the show and it's coming out and you get these amazing people that made your costume or made the sword and you're just like, wow, this level of skill that these, you know what I mean? So it's you're part of that fandom and it's a huge honour because the, you know, people are so passionate about it. It's weird that I've been in, it is a strange feeling, but it's a whole other world and really fun to be in.
Yeah, and very different from the world of I Swear. And then finally, I mentioned Waking Ned. I remember watching that on VHS however many years ago. Yeah.
Actually, sorry to interrupt you, but at Toronto, there was a guy in the queue, in the line, waiting to get into the screening, and he had a VHS of Waking Ned.
He was there to see I Swear, and he had a VHS that he wanted signing, so that was extraordinary.
But what I was going to ask you, what's the life lesson in that for young filmmakers or young people in that you make this movie seemingly on a shoestring and then it goes gangbusters, just even on financial terms? And look, this is a film show, so I'm not that interested, but it's just incredible where it started out and how much money and the life it had. Mm. What's the lesson?
Well, the lesson is I wish I would have been involved financially in that journey because it was extraordinary. But of course, I was just thrilled to have been able to write and direct my first film. And that was enough for me at that time. But I still, in particular in America, I still get people coming up to me. I still get people writing to me. It just stuck. And it's been many... I mean, what was that? That was like 1999, 26 years ago.
Wow.
And it still stuck. Yeah. And the interesting thing is that I was in Toronto, and that is where I first went to premiere Waking Ned Divine, as they call it in America. Mm-hmm. And I was back there 27 years later, about 2 weeks ago. And that was an incredible, to premiere I Swear. And that was a great experience.
In circles we move. Well, listen, I Swear is a terrific watch. I will be urging people to watch it. It contains multitudes, to paraphrase Walt Whitman or something pretentious like that. It's in cinemas from October the 10th. I've been talking to its writer and director, Kirk Jones. I nearly called him Kirk Douglas. That would have been embarrassing. And its lead star, Rob Arameo. Gentlemen, thanks a million.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to bring you a little flavour of it. There are some bad words in this, but I have to leave them in to give you a sense of the film.
It's called Tourette's syndrome. See things that I shouldn't.
What can you do?
Do you want to come in for something to eat, John?
Oh, fuck off, you wanker.
Well, it's nice to meet you too.
Sorry.
If you do anything here that you can't help, you never apologise.
Tommy, this is John. He's come to have a chat about the vacant position.
Right, I'll give you a rundown of the place.
Give me a cock in my hand.
Sakes. Can you make a decent cup of tea?
Oh, I am good at tea. Are you okay with the ticks and the swearing?
What ticks, what swearing?
We need to get you out, man.
I can see he's off the medication.
I don't think Tourette's is the problem. People not knowing about Tourette's is the problem.
Hey!
Educate them.
Yeah, a clip there from I Swear, which is in cinemas on the 10th of October. A remarkable watch. Heartwarming, sad, funny. You're not sure if you should be laughing, but apparently we have a blessing to laugh, and that makes part of John Davison's life such a filmable kind of life, I guess. And John Davison, as you heard there, is still very much alive. But I really enjoyed I Swear. Great British filmmaking. That's not a phrase I utter that often, but I just, it's the best of Britain. It really is. And it's working class Britain. It's just great, great watch. Check it out. That movie's going to be shown in civics classes, and it's not called civics classes anymore, but you know what I'm talking about. So that's I Swear in cinemas from the 10th of October. Up next, Chris Wasser has this week's new cinema releases, including Dwayne The Rock Johnson going full method. Now you're welcome back to the show. We turn now to the week's new cinema releases. We're going to be looking at the new Dwayne The Rock Johnson movie called The Smashing Machine and Jim Sheridan's latest movie, Recreation, which imagines the trial of Ian Bailey in the murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier, had there been one. Delighted to be joined now by film critic and arts journalist and regular reviewer on this very show, Chris Wasser. Chris, hello.
John, hello. Delighted to be here. How are you?
Very well. So listen, Dwayne, and he may not want The Rock Johnson in this title in this movie, because it's him going very serious, or reasonably serious, after 50 movies, which have been quite light.
Quite light, yeah. That's one way of putting it. He is going quite serious, and he is going for his Oscar, I think. Okay. He might even, you know, stand a chance here. He might even get into that group, but we'll come back to that. But he's also, you know, he's doing what Adam Sandler does every now and then, and what Adam Sandler has actually done for the Safdie brothers before, and this is actually a Benny Safdie film. The brothers have, you know, gone their own ways and are directing their own films this year. And what I mean by that is he's wearing his actor hat for a change, and you have an acclaimed filmmaker getting the best out of a performer in a way that we haven't seen them before. Now, I know Dwayne Johnson has been interested in the life of Mark Kerr for a while now, and so many people have. And for the uninitiated, Mark Kerr is a legendary mixed martial arts pioneer from Ohio. And there was a documentary in 2002 directed by John Hyams called The Smashing Machine, The Life and Times of Extreme Fighter Mark Kerr. And what that did was it kind of showed us the ultimate fighting championship, that's an American championship. We had the Pride Fighting Championship in Japan. But what we were seeing was the mixed martial arts movement in its very early days, where you had this kind of, you know, wider mainstream world that was still figuring out what the heck this thing is. And you also had, you know, various like organizations figuring it out for themselves, because you had wrestlers and boxers guys who were kind of, you know, competing in karate and taekwondo before, all coming together and still trying to figure out the rules of this competition. You know, where do we fight? How do we fight? What are we allowed to do? What moves are illegal? So that documentary showed all of that, but it also showed the brutality involved, you know, this no holds barred way of fighting. And it followed Kerr, who was this strong, confident, very likable guy, who had never really gotten used to, or never really had to get used to, the idea of losing. For him, it was just winning was everything. What's the point in getting up out of bed in the morning? What's the point in fighting if I'm not going to win?
That documentary also investigate demons he may have had?
Yes, yeah. So you basically saw, you know, two things in this documentary. What happened when he did, you know, inevitably lose his first bout in Japan, and also the demons involved, because as I said, you know, this sport is brutal, and particularly at the start when, you know, fighters are kind of doing everything because the rules are constantly changing. And you see that the pain this guy, yeah, he's a big guy, you know, he was called the Smashing Machine. I shouldn't have to tell you why he was called the Smashing Machine. That's the nickname that he earned for the way that he was at his opponents. This is a mountain of a man we're dealing with here. So to put his body through an awful lot every day, that eventually took its toll, and he was taking an awful lot of painkillers, and unfortunately was addicted to those painkillers. So there was the usual kind of fighter story, which we only ever see in fictional films, but this time it was happening in real life, where, you know, a fighter is everything in the ring, but then his personal life is falling apart. There's a toxic relationship, there's a stint in rehab, and then there's the inevitable comeback. So obviously you had filmmakers like Benny Safdie, you had actors like Dwayne Johnson watching from the sidelines, watching that documentary and thinking, let's make a feature.
Yeah, and we've seen lots of these, and I'm thinking chief among them probably something like Mickey Rourke's The Wrestler.
Yes.
I'm also thinking of, it was slightly different, it was a boxing movie, but the one with Christian Bale,
Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, now it's a slightly different story, but very similar, amazing. So did this need to be made?
I think it's a good thing that it was made, and that's all because we get to see Dwayne Johnson deliver what is, I think, the performance of his career. So he's playing Kerr as this, you know, as I say, strong, confident, unquestionably likable character who just, you know, he was a freestyle wrestler and a champion freestyle wrestler. And, you know, he's still like other fighters, like, you know, his friend Mark Coleman in here, played by real MMA fighter Ryan Bader. He's still getting used to this idea of, you know, being in a new competition like the mixed martial martial arts movement, like the UFC, like Pride Fighting Championship. So he's kind of making it up as he goes along, but because he's off to such a fine start, he thinks that he can never be beaten. So we see him at the beginning of the film all confident and ready, you know, to kind of take on the world. Then we see him, you know, after he's been beaten for the first time, and there's an extraordinary sequence where he's running around the arena trying to find the organizers of the competition to let him know that his opponent actually, you know, it was an illegal move that basically knocked him out. And we kind of just follow him through the arena, through, you know, elevators, through back to his changing room. It's an extraordinary sequence in a film that is full of extraordinary sequences, but sometimes is a little bit too choppy. So we see, you know, his relationship also with Dawn Staples, who was his girlfriend. The two of them live together, and kind of Benny Safdie presents their relationship. Again, I'll use the word choppy. It's a little bit strange because we're led to believe that there's some sort of tension between them, but that maybe she's the one that's potentially getting in the way of his career, holding him back. But we're also kind of going, how is he treating her? So that part of the film gets a little bit confusing. So it follows all that. It follows his addiction to opioids. It follows his stint in rehab and what he did then after he cleaned himself up, and maybe potentially after he fixed his relationship, how he made his name in this sport.
Okay. And what you're saying, though, is Johnson is pretty stellar in this, being a confident yet somewhat broken MMA fighter.
Yeah, that's it. I think so. I think the most valuable player here is Dwayne Johnson. Look, he is one of the world's most bankable movie stars.
Yeah.
Played every big screen adventure you can think of. He's been, you know, a superhero and a bounty hunter. You know, he's gone to space. He's been in the jungle more times than I can count. But we've never really seen him acting before. I was scratching my head trying to think, when's the last decent performance from Dwayne Johnson where it wasn't the muscles doing all the acting? And I think you'd have to go all the way back to Gridiron Gang, which isn't even that great of a film. But it's not that great of a film at all, but it was clearly Dwayne Johnson trying his hand at dramatic acting. It didn't suit him then, but I think it suits him now. You know, he's bringing into this film, you know, his own background in sports, you know, his own status as a WWE legend. So he knows a thing or two about putting his body on the line, you know, for his entertainment, but for mostly for ours. But once you see him in this film, you do start to kind of think to yourself, have you been pulling your punches? Have you been, you know, picking maybe the kind of roles that he plays? I was going to say that they're easy roles. They're not. Not everyone can do what he does. But he wants to give, you know, again, the serious acting thing a try. And I think it's a wonderful performance. It's quite soulful. It's quite vulnerable. I think a lot of people will talk about the prosthetics involved.
Because he's unrecognizable from some of the clips I've seen.
He is, you know, but it's one of those things. It's like Colin Farrell playing the Penguin in The Penguin. You can say to yourself, are the prosthetics doing all the work here? The answer is they're doing some of the work, but there's more to that performance than, you know, just this, you know, admittedly brilliant technical, you know, Hollywood wizardry. There's more to it. I think the real magic, again, like Collins, it's in the eyes and the kind of performance that, you know, he brings, you know, and also in his body, because, you know, what we're seeing, the prosthetics are on the face, but everything in the body is real. That's, you know, Dwayne Johnson putting in, you know, work at the gym there. And you can't fake that sort of thing. So I think his eyes, I think his physicality, they're working over time. I believed him. I believed every line. I believed every heartbreak. And the film sometimes doesn't really know how to tell how to tell the story of Mark Kerr. Yeah. But I always believed that Dwayne Johnson knew how to tell the story. I knew that I believed him as Kerr.
Okay, so he's brilliant in this. The plot a little episodic is what you're saying. So where would you land stars-wise for The Smashing Machine?
Yeah, it's a bit of an interesting one because it's an eventful film, but it's an uneasy one. And I think Benny Safdie, who's a great filmmaker, he's kicking against formula and he's kicking against genre. And a lot of people might be going into this thinking, I did actually, that I was going to get, you know, another Iron Claw. You know, a conventional, and when I say conventional, I love the Iron Claw, but I thought we were going to get this conventional sports tragedy of the week, weepy. But The Smashing Machine, it goes above and beyond to kind of be different. And I think that's, you know, there are advantages there, but there are also disadvantages because it sometimes feels as if the film is building and building and building, but it doesn't really get to, you know, something special. And I think one of the major flaws is that you've got a performer like Emily Blunt playing a character who's so underdeveloped, so underwritten. And I was just a little bit confused about their relationship, about who's at fault. You know, the fight scenes were kind of confusing. The relationship, just that part of Kerr's life was a bit disorganized. So I found it a bit choppy, emotionally detached, and just a bit, you know, it wasn't quite as engaging as I thought. But I will say it's a 5-star performance from Dwayne Johnson in maybe a 3-star film. I like this. It's, you know, it's flawed, but it is fascinating. And I think his performance will turn heads this award season, and he deserves it.
Okay, that's a tandem approach to star giving. 5 for the lead, Dwayne Johnson, and 3 for the film overall, according to Chris Wasser. 4, The Smashing Machines, which is Smashing Machine, which is in cinemas from this Friday. Let's take a quick clip.
There's no way I can run that.
Why?
Why? Because my tummy. You know what that would do to my tummy. I would get sick everywhere.
I mean, no, it's about perspective, okay? On the inside, you don't feel it. It's like you're not moving. You're like pinned against the wall and you're gonna love it. You're gonna love it.
Does it move on the inside?
It moves, but it's moving so fast that you can't even feel it.
Thanks so much.
I really want to go on the ride with her, but I have a sensitive stomach. Is there the center part in there? That's the thing that stays still, right? Can I stand in there in the middle part?
In the center part?
Yes.
No, man, that'd be a serious liability issue.
Well, where would you recommend I stand then? Because I don't want to get sick on the ride, but I do want to ride with it.
You don't want to get sick on the ride? I would suggest you don't go on the ride if you can't handle it.
Okay. Well, it's not that I can't handle it. It's just I'm choosing not to go on.
Okay, I'm going to go on the ride.
A clip there from The Smashing Machine. Now, you mentioned that the director, Chris, was trying to defy convention. You could probably make that case or not for Jim Sheridan's latest movie, Recreation. Now, I have seen this, albeit back in the summer, because regular listeners will know I did a long interview with Jim Sheridan about this and a bit more besides when it was shown at the Galway Film Fla back in July. But for people who don't know, this is Jim Sheridan, in essence, I was going to say reimagining, but it never actually happened, imagining the trial of Ian Bailey. Tell us a bit more about it, Chris.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because it's sort of, and I mean, they've put this in their director's statements, that they being Jim Sheridan and his co-director here, David Merriman. You'll see it in every piece written about this film. So it's unavoidable, really, that it's sort of Jim Sheridan and David Merriman's 12 Angry Men.
Yes.
It follows the plot, it follows the structure. You know, it's taking a real life story, but it's creating something fictional about it and putting it into that, you know, 12 Angry Men slot. And what I mean by that is you've got this trial where 12 jurors, you know, they've clearly been through the ringer here. It's been an extraordinarily tough trial for all the jurors. And we meet them at the beginning coming into this jury room while Ian Bailey, played silently by Colin Meaney, goes back to his cell. And the foreman of the jury played, actually, you know, you've got Jim Sheridan in an acting role here, which is unusual. So the foreman of the jury takes a vote the minute everyone sits down, and 11 jurors say that Ian Bailey is guilty. And it falls then to Juror 8. I mean, Sheridan is not even changing the rules here. It was Juror 8 in 12 Angry Men. It's Juror 8 here. And Juror 8 is played by Vicky Creeps. It's not that she doesn't think that Ian Bailey is guilty. She just says that she has this feeling that, you know, he might not be guilty. That, you know, she has a problem, basically an inherent problem with the prison system, and she just wants to discuss it. And like 12 Angry Men, again, you're going to be hearing that a lot here. It gets to a point where what she's talking about kind of convinces the other jurors, you know, all of whom disagreed, to kind of rethink. Then you also have, you know, this the noisiest opposer in the room is juror number 3, played by John Connors, and he makes a very aggressive argument for Bailey's conviction. So no matter who, forget about everyone else in the room that she has to convince, he will be the toughest one.
Yeah, and it, you're right, like it almost to the letter in some ways. Obviously, the case is different. It follows 12 Angry Men. And in essence, what we see as viewers is all the evidence in the Sophie Tuscon de Plantier murder trial, all the evidence against Ian Bailey. And Jim Sheridan, I mean, it's fair to say, and I mean, he said this, people know this, but he thinks there's huge reasonable doubt about Ian Bailey. So we're kind of, that's where we're getting to in this.
Yeah, I think so. It's unusual, though, that Sheridan has actually put himself into this. I did have a problem with it, unfortunately. I thought it was that decision was poorly judged, because Sheridan over the past few years has actually devoted a lot of his career, maybe over the past 5, 6, would it be 7 years, to this subject. You know, he gave us a series. There were 2 series about this murder in about 2020, 2021, and one of them was directed by Jim Sheridan. So after finishing that, you would think that he'd kind of, you know, he had told this story in a way, but this is still clearly in the system, and he's still clearly committed to the cause, and I do admire that. But I think it's one thing for a director to be behind the camera and kind of, you know, managing this kind of setup with David Merriman. It's another to get involved, and especially when you're not an actor yourself, because you do have some very talented performers in this film. So to put someone like Jim Sheridan, and again, you know, all all the respect in the world to Jim Sheridan, but he's not an actor. So to put him into the middle of that setup in such a prominent role, I just thought it undermined proceedings a little bit, because there are times where his character seems to potentially forget his lines. And it might be seen as, you know, a natural thing where, you know, when you get that many people in a room, there's going to be an awful lot of sentences that maybe go nowhere. But I just saw an actor who wasn't as good as at his job as, say, John Connors or Vicky Creeps or any one of the other performers in the room. So that was a bit of a problem for me. I think the other major problem is the fact that you've already got a case that is so confusing that so many people, you know, you don't need to tell, like, the chances are everybody in Ireland knows the details of this case, but listening to it again, it's still so confusing because there's still so many unanswered questions there. You know, chief among them, who actually did murder Sophie Tuscan Duplantier, and was it Ian Bailey? That's confusing enough without throwing in, you know, these fictional dramatic embellishments, you know, in terms of, we don't need to know the backstories of the jurors, and all of that stuff for me kind of got in the way and was a little bit awkward, a bit too contrived. I didn't really care about them. You know, you're supposed to be here for one thing, but it seemed as though all of that was all of the other characters and all the baggage that they brought and all the fictional baggage that they brought, that got in the way of things for me.
But did you not think, you know, this is possibly, you know, rightly or wrongly, the most famous unsolved murder in Irish history, or certainly of the last 50 years, possibly, you know, you could make a case for that. Did you not think it was a very inventive treatment of that?
Oh,
that,
yeah.
Here we were being asked to be jurors in this case that we all know so well, or a lot of us do.
Yeah, and it feels as though we're being invited to the table ourselves. I think that part of this project is intentional, that we kind of feel like we're being asked to make our mind up over the 90 odd minutes or so. And I do think it is very interesting. And I do, you know, I admire, you know, the fact that it is quite an unconventional piece of filmmaking. But it's quite, I just don't know if it was the right, I think, I don't know if the cinema is the right medium for this sort of project. I think maybe, and again, we're going back to 12 Angry Men's origins here, the stage, you know, I think this project might have worked well on the stage. I'm not quite sure. This is the one that we got. But I also thought maybe it was in bad taste at times. It's just to create this sort of soapy melodrama around this very serious case just didn't sit right with me. And there's an awful lot of peculiar decisions here. You know, you will see, like, Aidan Gillen appears at the beginning in a barrister role. That's fine. To have Colm Meaney playing a silent Ian Bailey, it doesn't really add anything to it, because his setup runs parallel to what's happening in the jury. So every now and then the film just kind of checks in on him, but for what reason, we're not really sure. And then to top it all off, there's a section towards the end, I won't spoil anything, where the lights turn off in the room and the others are kind of like reenacting basically what they think happened on that night in December 1996. And it just felt, again, like as if it was, this is bad taste. This is something.
Is it in any more bad taste or good taste than a documentary about the murder or that famous podcast? I mean, it still has the same tragic source material.
Oh, that's absolutely right. Yeah. And maybe Jim Sheridan is just feeding into the fact that we are all unfortunately obsessed with true crime media. So you're absolutely right. I suppose it's not done in any more bad taste than, let's say, any sort of Ryan Murphy real life murder series on Netflix. You know, we are obsessed with these. These are the kind of things that we are addicted to. So Jim Sheridan is kind of just next in line to give, you know, viewers exactly the kind of thing that they want, but it's not really what I want. That sort of genre has never really, I've never really taken to it at all. So I didn't really have the best time here. And I think part of me kept thinking, okay, you've had the documentary now, you've done this fictional feature. It's very, very strange. The material is a little bit too confusing. There's too many voices. You know, I think maybe if you weren't familiar with the case, you will probably come away with so many questions after watching this thing. It's a weird thing to say, but I really do hope this is out of Jim Sheridan's system now. I would love to see him return to different stories, because he is such an extraordinary storyteller. And he's always been an extraordinary storyteller because he picks different stories and he's never been one to repeat himself. So I would like to see him just move away from this now and go back into, you know, potentially something fictional. I just want this to be the end of it, to be honest.
Okay, we're disagreeing, but that's fine. The democracy of radio. I found it inventive and put a different spin on a well-known case. So what would you say, stars-wise, for recreation?
as I say, Sheridan is committed to the cause, you know, and he's rounded up some very talented actors here. I do wonder, though, if Vicky Creeps is a little bit too good for this sort of thing. But I was very frustrated with it. I found it just a little bit awkward, a bit too contrived, and just too many voices. There's just too much talking. Even I came away from it having watched both series, both documentaries, and having followed this case for years, as everyone else in Ireland has, I still came away from it very, very confused. So I'm going to say 2 stars.
Okay, I'm going to go 3.5 for Recreation, which is also on release from this Friday, the 2nd of October. I don't always agree with him, but it's always good to have him. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there, reviewing the week's new movie releases. Recreation, the new Jim Sheridan film, which is in select cinemas, and also The Smashing Machine. That is it for this week. Lots of stuff on the show next week. So much stuff going on in the next few weeks. I don't even know where what's going. But it's going to be good for the next few weeks. I would say something like, isn't it always good? But, you know, that would be self-congratulatory or something like that. I think I better go. I'm starting to ramble. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you choose to get your podcasts from. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage about the movies or TV shows or anything, ScreenTime@newstalk.com is the email address. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Stay warm and dry and out of the wind as best you can. And I will talk to you all next week.